This is Doug Beebe, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 23rd of June 2013. Doug Beebe, Part 1.
My full name is George Douglas Beebe. I was born on the 7th of July 1937 in Audenshaw, just outside Manchester.
So how old are you now then, Doug?
I'm 75 now, I'll be 76 next month.
Would you say that your father was an educated man?
Not highly educated, but he was quite a clever man. He worked in the brick industry when I was young, making bricks for J&A Jackson's, but his speciality was actually making curved bricks for building mill chimneys. So he knew about radiuses, arcs, and how many bricks thick the chimneys had to be. He had to work all those sort of things out. So that's how I learnt about circles and things as a kid.
He was a craftsman then, really?
Yeah, he started working warehouses in Manchester following his father, my grandfather, who worked for S&J Watts in Manchester in the warehouse. My father followed his father, sort of thing. But then the recession came and he had to get another job. And he got a job in the brickyard and stayed there throughout the Second World War. He did volunteer for the army, but was turned down because he was deaf in one ear through a football injury. And he then became a special constable. So he tried to do his bit for the war effort. And I say he worked in that industry until the late 40s, when he became groundsman and steward of the Denton Cricket Club, and he saw his time out there till he died in 1960, just after I'd gone in the RAF.
What about your own education, Doug? What sort of education did you have?
I started at Poplar Street Junior School till 11, and then I went to West End Secondary Modern Boys School at Ashton-under-Lyne until I was 15. Then I started an apprenticeship in Stamford Motors as an apprentice motor mechanic.
Do you think you were destined to be a man who worked with his hands?
I think so, yeah, because I failed the 11 plus, as is, not really understanding what it was at 11 years old, which was a disappointment to my father, because if I'd have passed it, I'd have gone to Audenshaw Grammar, and the cricket coach there was Cyril Washbrook, who my father knew, you see. So he, when I didn't get there, that was a black mark against me, I think. But I went to West End, enjoyed my time there. I was captain of the cricket team for the school, played football for the school, was vice captain of one of the houses. So, yeah, secondary modern schools then were the up and coming form of education after grammar schools.
Cricket as an adult?
I carried on playing through my teens and up to going into the Royal Air Force. I tailed off a bit later on, but through my middle teens, 16, 17, 18, 19.
Who for?
Denton.
And why? What was so attractive to you about motor mechanics?
Mother had got a car.
she needed fixing.
she got a car quite early on in my life. She had her own business on Guide Lane. She traded under the name of Ray Porter. And she bought an old Austin 10 through a friend of my dad's. I just paid an interest in the car. I was interested in the garage she bought it from, fellas around the corner. And it stemmed from that, really. I'd done woodwork at school. We didn't do any engineering at school. But, I was quite handy with my hands, as it were. So I got an apprenticeship at Stamford Motors. I stayed there until I was 21. I finished my apprenticeship at 21, stayed on as a mechanic but left in the June of the year I was 22, knowing full well that I was going to get called up for national service. I'd had deferment on deferment on deferment to go to Newton Heath Tech and get my qualifications there. So I packed my rucksack and went off to the Alps climbing for the season, as one did.
Was that a new interest, or had mountaineering been something in your background?
Oh, no, from school, we had a school teacher called Bernard McKenna who took us youth hostelling, and it stemmed from that. I got into fell walking and then progressed on to rock climbing and mountaineering, and so it was a natural progression sort of thing.
Tell me about national service. Where did you end up?
Principally at RAF Leeming in the RAF Mountain Rescue Team. So I was spending my time flogging over the moors or climbing on the Lakeland crags for the largest part of my 2 years national service. Started off with basic training and then trade training, and they wanted to make me a policeman, which didn't go down very well, because they I discovered that if I'd got into the RAF police, I couldn't get into the mountain rescue team. The only object of getting into the RAF was to get into the mountain rescue team. That's why I was there. And they said, no, if you're a policeman, you could be in charge of the guard room. So if there's a call out, you wouldn't be able to go. So I said, well, I don't want to be a policeman then. And they didn't take very kindly to that. So they made me an admin orderly, which was great from my point of view, because admin orderly, you can get on full-time mountain rescue service, which eventually I did. It came about because when I'd been in the Alps, I'd met a chap called Derek Walker, and he'd told me to, wherever you get posted, fill in this form and get it into the system. So I did that at Bridge North, at Netherhaven, every posting. I eventually got posted to West Drayton and filled it in there and put it into the system. And I didn't hear anything, so I wrote a postcard to Derek and said, you know, doesn't seem to be working, this system of yours. I'm not getting anywhere. And the thing was that at West Drayton, although I was an admin orderly, I could drive. And the CO had a driver from the pool of drivers from Uxbridge. When I was ported there, I got the job as CO's driver, which was very nice and, you know, treated very well. Anyway, Derek pulled a few strings or contacted people, and I was duly called into the CO's office. And he said, you seem to have friends in high places. And I said, sorry, sir, no, I understand. And he said, you filled in a form for mountain rescue service. I said, yeah, I filled one in every camp I've been to. He said, well, I put your application in the bin. So I said, why? Oh, I'm sorry about that. I thought I was, you know, in trouble, as it were. And he said, for all the time I've been here, I've wanted my own driver. Now I've got one, he's wanting to leave. And he said, anyway, I've had a message from the Air Ministry that you have to go on trial for mountain rescue service at Leeming. So pack your bags and you're going up there for a fortnight. So I went up and met the team up there and fitted in. Came back and packed my bags and went up to Leeming.
So and did you actually do any mountain rescues?
Yeah, we did one or two. The first one we went on was a cave rescue in the Yorkshire Dales. Because in the mountain rescue team, the team had substations at various places, like Keswick Police Station and, you know, the cave rescue systems in the Yorkshire Dales. And the first call-out was a cave rescue. In the mountain rescue team, we'd got three guys, Plug Lodge, Keith Richardson, with two of them, who were really experienced speleologists. They were very, very good quality cavers. And the civvy teams knew this. And so they called out the mountain rescue team as and when necessary, yeah. But, yeah, we went on quite a few search and rescue operations over the time I was there.
At what point do you think in your life you became aware that there was a place called the Antarctic?
Well, I mean, I knew it from geography lessons.
The white bit at the bottom?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the white bit at the top. And it got cold. And I went to Norway in 55 and found out about... I mean, I knew what glaciers were, but I hadn't been on one till then. And climbed on one in Norway. As far as actual people in the Antarctic was concerned, I suppose it was around the same time as I was in the RAF, because we were all interested in climbing and mountaineering and, you know, having a good time.
You went to visit the Fram when you were in Norway?
That was much later.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah. After I came out of the RAF, I had to get a job, because having resigned my job before I was called up, the firm weren't obliged to keep a job for me when I came out, which was, you know, I accepted that. There was no problem. And the first job I got was in a drawing office for Salford City Transport, doing bus body design and organising the apprentice training scheme. Then I wanted to get into education, and I made no secret of the reason for wanting to get into further education. They had very good holidays, and it meant that I was able to use the holidays climbing in the summer. So, I got a job in Birmingham at Handsworth Tech, teaching motor vehicle engineering. And after the first year, my sergeant, who was still in the RAF, was organising an expedition to climb in Norway. He planned on going to the Trolltinder Wall and the Jotunheimen. But he invited me to go, even though I was out of the RAF. And fortunately, the principal at Handsworth Tech, Herbert Marshall, was very, very understanding. I'd only been there a year, but the expedition went a week before we broke up for the summer holidays. And Ossie Ravenscroft, who was my immediate superior, I said, "Oh, I've had this invitation, but I can't go. You know, we don't break up till..." And he said, "No, you know, you've worked hard this year. Do you think you can get all your registers, all your exams marked and all your records up and completed in a week? Normally you'd got a fortnight to do it." And I said, "Well, I suppose I could if I really pull the stops out." And he said, "Well, I'll have a word with Mr. Marshall, and if he's agreeable, if you can do it, then you can start your holidays a week early, but you've got to come back a week early." And I said, "That's fair enough. I don't want an extra week's holiday, you know." Yeah. And Mr. Marshall agreed. So I was able to go on this expedition to Norway, and then, you know, that's how I came to be in there in 63.
So at what point did you become interested in going to the Antarctic?
Well, after the expedition in Norway, my heavy expedition gear was brought back to the UK via Bergen, and I hitchhiked down to Oslo and went and looked at the Fram, and it all stemmed from there, really.
Fram. I mean, I know the Fram, was, of course, was not the Antarctic, that was the...
Well, the Fram was Amundsen's
ship.
We met some young ladies while we were up in Norway, and one of them, there were two girls. One of them went out with Pete Brown, and the other one went out with one of the other lads. I think it was Doug Fletcher, just for a stroll. And we met them on a bus, and they were going to the same area as us. And when I was down in Oslo, one of these girls said, "Well, come round, you know." They were very nice and very hospitable people. And she said, "We have this museum of the Fram." And I said, "Oh." So on her say-so, I, you know, waltzed out of Oslo and up to the Fram to have a look at it. And it was in reading about the Fram and the fact that he went down to the Antarctic in it, stimulated me, sort of thing, and got me interested. Yeah.
And so the attraction, was it the ice and snow, or was it the mountaineering you might be able to do down there?
I think it was the ice and snow. Yeah. The I found out that there were mountains down there eventually, but it was the ice and snow. And when I got back to Birmingham, I read Shackleton's book, Endurance, and thought, ooh, they had a bit of a rough time. I hope it's not like that now. That sort of stimulated the interest and got me going, yeah.
So how did you actually make the next step? There was a moment of fate, wasn't there, in a shop?
Yeah. The students' union at Handsworth Tech, we'd got a little climbing group together, and they decided they'd got some money and they wanted to buy some climbing equipment. And I'd got very good relationship with Bob Brigham at Manchester, Brigham Shop, because I'd dealt with his father when they were out in Conran Street, and he'd just moved into the centre of Manchester at Cathedral Street. So I went in there and said, we want to buy some climbing ropes for the Students' Union and some gear. And as we were talking, I just happened to say, hey, Bob, have you ever heard of this outfit called FIDS? And he said, oh, yeah, I've supplied him with some climbing ropes just quite recently. Hang on a minute. And he went in his office and came out with the address. And he said, there you are. So I wrote to him.
Completely on spec, not requiring to an advert.
No, completely on spec. Just wrote to him asking, how did I go about applying for a job? Because I didn't know where they advertised. I hadn't any idea. I don't think they were going to advertise in any Times Educational Supplement, which is where I looked for jobs at that time. So, I just wrote to him and I got a reply. And
from?
Bill Sloman. And saying, yeah, but, you know, please let us know your qualifications and experience and so on. So I sent him a letter back and eventually Phil Farms in and went down for an interview.
What do you? I appreciate it's now nearly 50 years ago, but what do you recall of the interview?
Being asked very basic motor vehicle engineering questions, but, you know, if you haven't got a battery charger, how would you get the maximum out of a battery under cold conditions? So knowing sort of thing that, you know, having read a little bit and knowing what sort of conditions they were working under down there, I said, well, just get it as warm as you could. And they said, how would you do that? And I said, well, it depends what you've got to heat it up with, not knowing. And they said, we have primer stoves. I said, oh, well, hang it over a primer stove. How long do you think that would take? I said, blooming long time, because there's a lot of mass there. Mm-hmm. A battery is a very solid object. To warm it up and really get it heated through would take a long time. I don't know how long, but it'd take a long time. And they seem to accept that. Yeah.
So did they also ask you about your mountaineering?
Just a little, yeah. Mm-hmm. They asked me what I'd climbed, and at that time, I'd climbed some reasonable big mountains like Mont Blanc. And
did you walk out thinking you'd got the job?
No. There was no indication of that. I mean, it was all very amicable and very nice, but they said, "Oh well, we'll be in touch." And I explained that working in education, I'd got to give a full term's notice. Otherwise, I wouldn't have got back into education at that time. And they said, oh, well, we appreciate that, so we'll let you know well in advance. And they did. Because then the contract came through and I signed the contract. And I signed on for £500 a year for 2 years and agreed to go to Cambridge for the 1 week course there. And that was it. And then a bit later on, I got another letter asking me if I would accept an alteration in contract. Uh-huh. Strange, no? But I accepted it, because they'd just become BAS and they'd given you a rise of £1 a day. So my money went up by £365 a year. And on 500, that was a large percentage increase. Yeah. But I've still got that letter somewhere at home.
I hadn't heard that before, so...
You know?
Oh, right, yeah. I hadn't realised there was a big difference between FIDS and BAS. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
But did he know where you were going to be sent at that point?
No.
When did he find out you were destined for Halley?
That would be, I think they notified us shortly after we'd been to Cambridge that you were going to Halley Bay.
Would you know what that meant?
Yes, I did by the time I got notification, because they'd explained where the bases were when we were at Cambridge. They said there's this, and Stonington, and you know, Deception and so on. And then there's Halley over there.
1,000 miles away.
Yeah, yeah. And somebody said, oh, you're going to the Blue-Eyed Bay. You know, and I didn't really, you know, understand what that was at all till later. Yeah.
What does it mean?
We were called the Blue-Eyed Bay because we got more films than anybody else. Because we got quite a stock of films to see us through the long winter. And the retort was, well, you know, you're in the banana belt sort of thing. Because they weren't as far south, yeah.
What was the journey like? You went via South Georgia, I think, didn't you? Stanley, then South Georgia?
Montevideo first.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was... we set off from Southampton, and I've got to confess, I don't know whether it still applies to me, but I wasn't a very good sailor, so the first few days I was rather sick, but eventually got my sea legs, and the doc, well, we got two doctors on board at that time, and I was suffering from seasickness. B, I'd trapped a finger badly working in a garage for a friend, and the nail was due to come off. And so the doc, not the doc John Wilson that came to Halley Bay, but the other doc, took it off for me after we'd been at sea for a few days, you know, which hurt, but it was necessary, because he said if we don't get rid of that old nail, it could affect the growth of your new nail. So anyway, you can see it's reasonably all right now, but that was one of the first things on board ship, being seasick and having my fingernail taken off. The journey down to Monte was very good. We got down to Montevideo on I think it was New Year's Day. The thing I remember, I mean, various things on board ship, but the food was absolutely superb. And on, I think it was the Christmas Day, I think the Danes celebrate on Christmas Eve, but on Christmas Day, the chef came in with the most magnificent, what do they call it, baked Alaska. Mm. And it was a big platter, it was like that. And it was in the shape of a swan made out of, you know, meringue over a massive block of homemade ice cream in it. And he came in with it into the saloon, and it was absolutely beautiful, because he'd obviously had a blow lamp on it to darken the wings and so on. It was a work of art. It was a shame to actually break it up and eat it.
This was on the Kister Down, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. The little red ship, yeah.
Did that take you all the way to Halley, that ship?
Yeah, yeah. We went into Monte first, then to Stanley, then to Signy, then to South Georgia, and then down to Halley.
Tell me what you thought of Halley, because it's pretty bleak, isn't it? There's not much to see.
No, that's true. Well, when we were there, it was. Yeah, the first impression was, where is it? Because we drove up. On the kegs, we were driven up from the Kister, up the long ramp of Halley Bay, and then up, and you saw these aerials stood up, and oh, right, and we'd been told that the huts were under the snow, and actually there was one roof showing of the office block, so they were still going into that from the surface, getting into the office block, but the
was
rest
this Halley 2?
No, this was Halley 1.
Oh, still Halley 1, okay.
Yeah, the IGY hut was about 60 feet down at that time, and then there was the living hut, and then there was the office block. So you'd got three levels, and you'd got shafts going down to them to get down, because the living hut originally been designed for a double story, but they never put the top story on, so it had a flat roof which kept caving in, causing a few minor problems with lumps of ice and things, drips.
Had they trained you up on the equipment, on the kegs and the other? So you were meeting, as a mechanic, you were meeting these strange creatures, these new machines that you hadn't seen before?
Yeah.
How did you familiarise yourself?
Well, just by working on them. Unfortunately, there was only the changeover days with the mechanic that was there before. But Brian Porter, who was the other mechanic, Shreddy, I think he'd worked on kegs somewhere at one time, or he'd been on a course, so he knew them. But they were basically a straight six-side valve engine that powered the tractor.
And were Muskegs the only tractors you had?
Yeah.
Were they fit for purpose?
I think so, yeah. They weren't built for the job they were doing. They were built for working in northern Canada over the tundra up there. But they were comparatively light ground pressure, so they'd got rubber tracks, rubber driving sprockets. They worked well once you got them warm. One of the things that we did was they sent down with us Bailey heaters. Now, I don't know if you remember those, but they're you could get them in, I think it was up to 250 watts, like an overgrown light bulb, to insert in your water system to keep the water warm, which was great in the UK, but the temperatures down there were, not on. And Brian Porter and I talked this over and said, it's useless fitting them. They don't get hot enough. But the system's good. So we got an immersion heater element and made a tube for that and put that in.
Into where? Into the radiator?
No, into the cooling system. We modified the flow of the pipes from the radiator so we could house this, I think it was, some of them were 3 kilowatt immersion heaters, because we'd got some of those on base, and we put them in, and an umbilical cord to a socket, and so you didn't have to go out and start the Webasto heater, the hot air heater, to warm the engine and thin the oil out, because you could plug it in when you were on base, and this immersion heater would keep the whole engine warm.
The cooling system became a heating system?
Yeah. Yeah, it did.
Was that your idea?
Well, it was Brian and I worked it out between us when we saw these Bailey heaters and said, well, the idea's good, but the.
Would you have to refer that to, I don't know who the base leader was in your first year.
It was Phil Cotton.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. Would you have to refer that to Phil Cotton?
No, I don't think so. No, we just got on with it.
Yeah.
We said, we fancy doing this. Because Al Famflet was there to redo, rewire the IGY hut, and when we were talking to him, he said, for some reason or other, they've got a stock of these immersion heaters down there. We'll have a couple of those.
So you rescued them from the IGY hut, did you?
They were on stock. They weren't being used.
Right.
They were just
in stores.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the other modifications you made to the muskegs?
None.
The snow not tend to get into the radiator grill?
We had covers. We had engine covers over that made out of canvas. But they were already on when we went down. We did make the Webasto heaters were on the roof of the cab on two of the tractors. We had to make ducting down to get the hot air down into the engine compartment and particularly onto the sump to thin the engine oil out. So we soldered, I think they were T-tins or some sort of tins, together to make the ducting and get the hot air down there. But it worked. Yeah.
But Heath Robinson, perhaps?
Well, it looked it, yeah, but it did work. I mean, we made a good job of soldering the tins together and making sure that the vibrations wouldn't shake them apart and so on by stiffening the joints.
And were the tractors kept in sheds? Or?
No, they were kept outside.
Right.
We had a workshop, a garage to work on them, down a long ramp, but we worked on them outside if conditions permitted and it was necessary, much to John Wilson's chagrin, I suppose. He started a programme of dexterity in a fridge. Now, it sounds stuffed in the Antarctic to have a fridge, but he did. And he put both Brian and I onto it. But then when he found out that we were replacing points in distributors outside in the cold and in little screws, just putting your silk gloves on so they didn't burn your fingers, he took us off it and said, no, you know, you're getting too much practice outside. It's no good. I'll do it on other people.
Do you think you were holding your own with these muskegs? Was maintenance okay, or were you always fighting a losing battle?
They were getting a bit tired by the time we get there, yeah. But I think this was why some of them broke down various times, because they had been worked hard in previous years. Mm. Maintaining the engines was no problem, but it was the other things that packed up on us, really.
Did you get out into the field much?
Yes, yeah.
With muskegs or with dogs?
With muskegs initially, and it was only after the accident that I turned to being a dog man.
Right.
Simply because they wanted somebody to work with Rodrigue Jones, Jeff Lovegrove and Tony Haynes.
So these notes I've got from Rod about lyovers, that was later?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, can we talk about this accident? Because it happened not long after you got there, I think, is that correct?
Well, it happened the next summer.
Right.
We arrived in January, February 65. And the accident happened the next summer.
Yeah.
We'd already done one field trip with Phil to bring the caboose back.
Oh, yeah, tell me about that.
Well, after the unloading was over, Brian and I serviced the tractors, and then we shot off because there was two guys out in a caboose with a mini beastie, and the generator had gone, so they hadn't been able to do anything. They must have been bored out of their skulls with no work to do. So that was my first experience of going across the Bob Pye Crossing with Phil chipping his way in front.
With a bog chisel. A bog chisel.
It was a long pole with a chisel end, metal chisel end on it, and it was known as a bog chisel because I think at some places they'd use them for chipping frozen excreta in the bog to make it
and the turdicles.
Yeah.
So he was probing for crevasses.
He was, and he took the route up, and I was following his line, and all of a sudden it went sideways.
This was
when we were going up the Bob Pye Crossing, and I'd put one track into a crevasse, and the pictures in of Ice and Men with Brian Porter standing there with his foot on the tractor, but it was me that was driving. It was me that got the spare batteries clattering around my legs and, you know, emptying acid over my feet. So just one of those things.
How did you deal with that?
Well, we just climbed out, and I rubbed snow on knowing the acid had got onto my boots, onto my mutlucks and my waterproofs. I just rubbed it with snow and hoped it would dilute the acid, but it didn't. After about a week or so, they all started to fall apart.
Didn't get through
to me.
No, it didn't get.
The only injury to me was the bruising through the batteries bouncing out of the rack and crashing into my legs.
How did you get the tractor out of the...
We got another tractor and just winched it out sideways, pulled it out, being very careful not to drag the track off sideways. But, we just put a 3-to-1 with pulleys and the winch cable and just pulled it out.
And then he got the caboose and brought it back?
Yeah, we got the caboose and brought it to the top of the crossing. Then we went off to do depot laying for the next spring journey to the Tottenfjallaer Mountains. And there we, one tractor broke down there by the driving sprocket sheared on one side. So we made a ski for the tractor out of oil drums, cut oil drums up, and lashed a ski onto it, and then lashed to the other two tractors together and put cables in, and we towed it all the way back to base across the crossing and the caboose. Yeah.
You had to be very inventive, didn't you? Because, I mean, resources in the field are pretty minimal.
Yes, yeah, you make use of what you've got.
So were your creativity skills being challenged a lot more there than they had been back in this garage in England?
Yeah, I suppose they were, yeah. I never considered that before, but, yeah, you just got on with what you'd got, yeah.
Let's talk then, if we may, about the expedition that came to grief in the summer of 66 with Wilson, Wild, Bailey and Ross, who went off. My understanding of it is was that you were involved in the early stages of that expedition, but then there was a mechanical failure at Pyramid Rocks.
Yeah, we broke a drive shaft.
It splintered. Didn't
prop
it?
Shaft. Sorry?
Did it splinter between your legs?
Yeah. Well, the hardy spicer coupling went between me feet and rattled around. If it had been the other one that had gone, it probably turned both my feet off.
Oh,
but,
right.
It just clattered around and that was it.
That must have been slightly alarming.
Yeah, but, you know, we came out of it all right. So we towed that one up to Pyramid Rock and depoted it there with the arrangement that the next journey out would bring spares out to repair it and decluspers and did that the next year. So that was one tractor out, and that left us with two. We serviced one and got that ready for more work, and Di Wild and went off with that one, with John and Jerry and Ian Ross. And Brian Porter and I were left at Pyramid Rock with the other one, working on the other tractor. Rod and Lou went off with one dog team, and Jeff Lovegrove and Tony Haynes went off with the other, and they went off to go along the mountains.
Louis Jukes,
is it? Yeah.
So the fact that you stayed at Pyramid Rock, was that always part of the plan? Or always?
Yeah.
It was, so there was no way you would have been with the Wild party?
No. It was just one tractor going that way, because Die Wild had been that way the previous year and knew the route. So there was, you know, he was quite happy. One tractor, enough fuel to get him down to where he wanted to drop.
The depot.
And drop John Wilson and Ian Ross, because they were going to arrange some isolated mountains further out. And they were passing a mountain called Stella, which Ian wanted to look at on the way back with the dog team. So the plan was that they'd go out to the mountains and then Jerry Bailey and Di Wild would come back in the tractor. And Rossi and John would work the far ones and then work Stella on the way back.
What was the first indication you had that something had gone wrong?
A dog passing the tent door.
A dog?
A dog passing the tent door. I was in the tent.
At Pyramid Rock?
At Pyramid Rock. Can't remember exactly what I was doing, but I was in the tent and I saw this dog and I thought, where'd that dog come from? And then there was another dog, and it was Rossi coming back with Ian Ross coming back with his dog team. And that was the first indication that we got there was something really wrong.
Tell me about that moment. What do you remember of it?
Well, I went out to, you know, jumped out of the tent and saw Rossi, and I said, what are you doing here? And he said, there's been an accident, and he was broken. He was still shaking. He was in a terrible state. To put a lighter note on it, he'd been a heavy smoker, and when we were leaving Halley to set off, I'd said to him, "Oi, you're going to have to cut down on your smoking, or I need another sledge to carry your fags." And he said, "Yeah, yeah." And I admired him from the point of view that he cut his consumption of cigarettes down to less than 10 a day. In fact, I think he was down to about 3 a day by the time we got to the mountains. But when he came back from that accident, he was chain smoking again. He was, you know, it had affected him that way.
Can you remember the conversation?
Not exactly, no.
Did he explain?
The gist of it was, he said, the tractor's gone down the hole, the others are dead. And it transpired that he'd been riding on the back sledge, keeping an eye on the dogs, because we didn't carry the dogs on the sledges. They ran on a trace between the sledges, so they were getting the exercise. We weren't sure about actually carrying them on sledges at that time. And that was an innovation, as it were. And what he said was, he'd been looking at Stella, this mountain, as they were going past through a pair of binoculars. And when the tractor stopped, it meant that he was able to focus his glasses on it, and he was having a good look at it. And when it didn't set off again, he turned round to see why not, and it wasn't there. And that was it. And it had gone down, and the first sledge had broken loose off the back of the tractor, and the A-frame had dug in and jammed it on the top of the crevasse by digging into the opposite side. Yeah.
Did he tell you what had happened, what he tried to do?
He did, yeah. He said he'd, he'd been shouting down to Jerry after a while, and then it all went quiet. It had obviously affected him more than he realised, and I think more than we realised at the time as well, because he'd got a very heavy machine for doing charges through the ice, which was a heavy, solid piece of gear, and he brought that back with him on the sledge in the dog team. But he took the Primus prickers out and only had one in his Primus stove, with his Primus stove, because he wanted to reduce the weight. Totally illogical, you know, but that's the way it had affected him.
Had he talked about weighing up whether to go down after them or not?
No. No, I don't think he ever mentioned that.
Right. So what was the next thing that happened? You tried to reach base?
We got the radio that we'd got going.
His had failed, hadn't it?
Yeah, we'd got one. Brian Porter had got one in the tractor. So we got busy and we contacted Rod and Lou and
in the sledge.
Yeah, and Jeff Lovegrove and Tony Haynes, and said, "There's been an accident. You better come back to Pyramid Rock." And I think it was when they got back, we made contact with base, or it might have been before. I honestly can't remember. But I can remember my Morse was not very good. Other people were much better on the key than I was. So I was the leg man. I laid on my back and pedalled the generator. And that was, you know, when we sent the SOS out to Halley, that we'd had a fatal accident.
Mm. What was the instruction from Halley? From Phil Cotton? Base leader?
I don't know what I don't know whether he sent us any instructions or not, but Jeff Lovegrove, it was who sort of then took the leadership of the party and said, "Well, we'll have to go out to the site and rescue what we can." So we then got the tractor and followed the tracks out to where it was. When Brian and I were at Pyramid Rock, each evening I'd been going up to the top of climbing the nearest mountain. You know, I'd got a route up there that I could virtually trot up, really, and with a pair of binoculars, looking for headlights coming back in if they were motoring in the evening, and of course never saw any. So, but that was me evening exercise, a morning exercise, because you go up in the morning, you go up in the evening. But when all of us got back to Pyramid Rock, then we all went out. You know, there were the seven of us went back out there and did what we could, rescued the equipment.
Can you describe the scene when you arrived at the accident location?
Rather barren, flat area, didn't look crevassed at all, really. But the sledges were there, and the front sledge was jammed on the lip of the crevasse with the airframe stuck in the other side. So we got busy with the other tractor and pulled them away from there and got them clear of that, and then very carefully looked which way the crevasse was running and realised that it was somewhere just over 100 feet deep. So it wasn't. It was a split type of crevasse. It wasn't, one of these bottle-shaped things or anything like that. It was just a straight crack in the ice, and the tractor was, about 100 feet down.
So if you looked over the edge, could you see the tractors?
Yeah, you see the tractor down there.
A decision was taken to go down on a rope.
Yeah.
And did you volunteer for that?
Yeah.
Was this your mountain rescue experience coming into play?
I think it was, yeah. I just said to Jeff, I'll go down if you want me to. And he said, yeah, I think you're the best guy for the job. So I went down. The prime objective of going down was to A, take photographs, and B, rescue anything we could, particularly a radio, because we were short of radios. But there was nothing to be brought out, equipment-wise. So I just took photographs from where I could and then came out.
Did you think twice about going down?
No.
You were quite happy it was going to be safe?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't consider that I was in any danger at all going down, because I could abseil in, and if necessary, I could prussock my way out. But we'd got electron ladders. So we rigged the electron ladders, and Shreddy Porter said, I'll throw them down after you've got down. So I said, yeah, that's fine. I don't know how I'll climb an electron ladder with crampons on, but, it'll be entertaining.
What's an electron ladder?
It's what you use in caving, for cave rescue. It's like wired down and rungs across, and they're only 9 inches wide, and they roll up. So they're quite good for rescue work.
So it's a kind of metal rope ladder?
Metal rope ladder, yeah, basically. Yeah. And you clip them together. They've got a carabiner attachment. And so you can piece them. They come in 25 feet lengths. So we'd got, I think we'd got four of those. But, or was it three? They didn't reach the bottom anyway. There was, it was somewhere up there. Was the electron when Shreddy threw it down, and because he was on the edge as the communications with me up at the top. So when I was ready for coming out, he said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I can't fly to it. I said, you're going to have to give me a pull. I said, the crevasse was too wide to bridge at that point to get up to the bottom of the electron ladder. So he said, we'll pull you up and then you grab the ladder. So I said, right, okay. So they did. They hauled me up on my lifeline until I could get my feet were level with the bottom of the ladder. And I got hold of the ladder and got my feet on. And I said, right, I'm on the ladder. So then they relaxed. And of course, my weight came onto the electron ladder. The electron ladder cut into the lip of the crevasse like a cheese cutter. And all these blocks of snow came tumbling down on my head. This wasn't pleasant. But, I had a breather there. And then I started to climb up. And Shreddy said, would it be quicker if we pulled you? And I said, it would. I'd made about 20-odd feet by that time. And I said, yeah, it would if you can. And he said, hang on. And all of a sudden the rope went tight and I came out the top like a cork out of a bottle through the gully that the electron ladder had cut into the lip of the snow. Because they were like a tour war team. Everybody was on the rope and pulled me out.
Can you describe what you saw when you got into the crevasse? You looked down.
When I got down, the tractor had gone down tail first, and so the cab had been folded over the front of the tractor, and that was it. Everything was crushed in there. I could see Jerry, who'd obviously been driving because he was in the centre seat, but I couldn't really see the other two at all. They must have been somewhere in the crushed cab. But the crevasse had narrowed off towards the bottom, and as it had slid down, it had gradually, well, not gradually, it had obviously folded the cab over the front, and it was jammed between the two walls of the crevasse. The bottom of the tractor was jammed tight in the crevasse.
So Wilde and Wilson had been killed instantly?
Yeah.
But Jerry Bailey, who was in the cab and therefore higher up?
Well, he was in the driving seat, so he was nearer the front, and the others would be slightly behind him. So they were crushed, but as the cab folded over, it had crushed his bottom part, but folded him almost out through the windscreen.
And that's why he could call for
a
while?
Yeah.
Before he passed away as well?
Yeah.
How were your feelings at that point? What do you remember that?
Well, obviously upset at losing three good friends. But I was there to do a job. Jeff had said they'll want photographs of this. So I'd taken a camera down and I took photographs. And Bass got all the photographs. We never saw them.
But, you didn't keep prints?
No. No, it was... I think I'd got slides in at that time, and they had them all. So we didn't have those, but no, it was... I don't think I got emotionally upset at that point. In fact, I don't think I got emotionally upset ever. But it was, you know, sad that they'd lost their lives that way.
Was there anything that could be rescued from the tractor?
No.
It was so nothing. Completely crushed?
Yeah. The tractor was crushed. Anything that had been on the tractor, I looked at, because there was this layer of snow below the tractor. There was a gap underneath it and snow, and this was the snow that had fallen down and filled the bottom of the crevasse. And anything... Jerry Bailey had a large trunk that he carried on the roof, and that was nowhere in sight. And the only thing I could work out was that had gone further down into the crevasse and then been covered by snow, because I couldn't find anything on there. I've got to confess, I was walking about very gingerly on this snow, because I thought, well, if this goes, I'm going to be going further down than the tractor is. So it was, you know, I was... prodding with my eyesight to make sure my footings were all right.
When you got back out again, what was the next thing you had to explain to your colleagues what you've seen?
Yeah. Yeah. Just explain just what I've said, you know. The surprising thing is it had gone straight down. It hadn't turned or wobbled or anything. It was perfectly upright with its tail, you know, the towing hitch down. Looking up to the top.
The bonnet and the windscreen looking
well,
to the sky.
Yeah, the front of the tractor and the cab was folded. The cab was folded over the front of the tractor, but it was still vertical. Mm. Yeah.
Was there anything religious that happened at that point to Jeff?
Yeah, Jeff was very good that way, although he knew that John Wilson was he an atheist or agnostic? I can't remember which. But he said... I know John was not religious, but he knew Di and Jerry. And he said he'd like to say a few words. So we made a cross, we put it up,
A wooden one?
A wooden one, yeah. And he said we had a short service, and he said a few words. And then we hitched everything up and went back to Pyramid Rock.
Was there any question of trying to retrieve the bodies?
No.
Why was that?
Well, A, we hadn't got any equipment that we could retrieve the bodies. It would have taken... It just wasn't feasible. It wasn't possible, in my view. You would have needed cutting gear to cut into the cab to you know... And we, you know... It wouldn't have been nice. It would be far nicer to leave them where they were and treat that as a grave.
The question also arises what to do with the bodies, because couldn't really bury them, could you?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you got them out, you'd only want to dig another hole and put them in it, so leave them in the one they're in. Yeah.
Tell me about the mood on base when you got back. Were people...
I think they'd got over it by then, basically.
Was anybody blaming anybody? Or blaming themselves?
Not that I'm aware of, no. One of the things was, we found out afterwards, that Di Wilde had actually done the route before, but he'd been a certain... He wasn't on exactly the same line as he'd followed the previous summer.
He'd gone astray?
I don't know whether he'd gone astray, but he was probably straightening the route out to the mountains and wasn't aware that there was any crevasses there. And the thing was that I think we only saw one other crevasse in that area. So it was, you know, a bit of a freak spot that he'd hit. But no, I don't think there was any blaming.
So the base leader didn't feel, Phil Cotton, the base leader, didn't feel remorseful in any way?
Oh, I think he felt remorseful, yeah. He was certainly upset because, he'd worked with Di all the previous year, yeah. But I don't think there was any blame levelled at anybody. It was just one of those very unfortunate accidents.
The practice that they were following was to have the dogs behind the lead tractor. And in Ice and Men, Vivian Fuchs suggests that if the dogs had been leading the tractor rather than being behind, they would have stopped at the crevasse.
Yes, possibly. Yeah, because they could smell them. Yeah. it sounds silly, but those dogs know where the holes are. Mm. I don't know how. The dog brain is... not my forte, as it were, but they certainly knew where crevasses were. So possibly he's right, but on the other hand, the dogs weren't pulling a load when they were being transported on a centre trace between the sledges, so they were getting just a trotting day out, really, and saving their working life to pull in a sledge, so we were able to cover greater mileages that way. Later on, we put dogs onto sledges and carried them, and that meant that you got more range in a day.
So there was no change in practice then, even though this accident had happened because the dogs were behind the tractor rather than in front. In future expeditions, that situation remained the same. Or was there a modification in the procedure?
If you knew you were in a crevassed area, then yeah, the dogs went out in front.
After the accident?
Well, and before.
Oh, right.
They'd done that on the Bob Pye crossing.
So if Di Wilde had suspected there might be crevasses around, he would have put the dogs out in front?
I think he would, yeah. Because he was an experienced field man. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
The fact that Jeremy Bailey survived for a while and could shout up to Ross.
Yeah.
That was kept quiet at the time, wasn't it?
It was.
Were you told not to say anything?
Yes.
Was it explained to you why?
It was explained to me why much later. It was to spare the feelings of the people who had, the relations of the people who had died. Yeah. To say that they all died instantly. But in Jerry's case, that was not so.
So there was a cover-up, but for good reason?
Yeah.
Mm. Did you go and see the relations?
No.
Did anybody from Harry go and visit the relations?
Oh, I think, yeah, some did, yeah. But I stopped off in the Falkland Islands. I didn't come back to the UK. So, I think they did, yeah.
So really there wasn't... One of my questions here is, were there any lessons to learn? But in fact, there weren't really, were there?
Well, there were from the tractor point of view, because they started fitting cages over the tractors then to stiffen the top so that they wouldn't crush. And the living cabs that were on the two that we had were, in comparison, quite flimsy structures. They gave good shelter for the driver and the, you know, people travelling in, and you'd got two bunks in there, so two of you could live in there. You didn't have to put a tent up. But they weren't strong. They wouldn't take an impact like falling into a crevasse. So somebody came up with a design whereby they put a slight scaffolding poling over the top and bolted to the actual chassis of the tractors.
And you did that, did you?
No, that was done later on, yeah. I think we were involved in just one of those mods.
So it was a kind of a roll bar effect.
It was, exactly.
So that was the lesson that was learned
from
those deaths.
Yeah.
Let's talk about something else.
Right.
Thank you very much for doing that. You actually had your own complications whilst you were down there, because you did slip the disc, didn't you?
Yes.
What's the story there?
That was later on. We went out to Depot Lay for the Therons trip the next summer. So after I got back from being in the mountains with Rod and doing the surveying there, we got back to base. The ship came in, and then the autumn journey was to lay depots ready for the spring journey going to the Therons. So Milne Samuel was leading that field party, and we went out with the tractors and the heavy loads to Depot Lay. We got to where we were to lay one depot, and the weather started to blow. And it blew, and it blew, and we sat there for 21 days. So the programme was then three weeks behind, and we were in trouble, because we couldn't complete the programme with 3 weeks out like that, no way. So Sam decided that we would make one big depot, which was like the size of a bungalow, and then we'd hightail it back. And it was while I was digging a tractor out with that, my foot slipped, and I twisted and slipped a disc out in my lower spine, which sort of took the use of my right leg away, which hurt. I managed to keep going, being very ginger and, you know, walking with a terrible limp and falling over from time to time. And then when I got back to base, the new doctor, Ron Lloyd, said, you've slipped a disc, and he looked at my spine, and he put me in plaster Paris from my armpits to my crutch.
Were you able to do any work at all?
Not really, no. Climbing ladders was a bit difficult. I couldn't get over to the garage, really. So I did paperwork.
For 3 months,
yeah. And just helped round the base and did what I could, helping the cooks, doing anything that they wanted doing, sweeping up, doing gash, doing whatever, you know, I could possibly do to try and keep myself busy and useful, as it were.
Did the treatment work?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. Because when the plaster came off, then I could walk without a limp, and I hadn't got this searing pain down my leg. And he said, oh, it's back in, but you'll have to watch it, because it could go out again, you know, without too much effort. So I had to be a bit careful. and he decided that I should wear a corset.
Which he just happened to have with him.
No, like everything else in Fids, you either make it or mend it. You either make it out of Dexian or you mend it with Araldite. We'd got some sail canvas. He'd got tourniquets, like straps with buckles on in his supplies. So we got the sail canvas out and a sailmaker's needle and twine and stitched this corset together, and he said it needs stiffening up the back, by which time I was able to get over to the garage sort of thing. So we got some 3/8 steel rod and bent that in a vice, and he kept offering it up to my spine and say, stand up straight and right, that's the right curvature, we'll stitch that in. And we stitched it into the corset and strapped it on, and that's stiffened my lower spine and stopped me damaging myself further.
Before that, you'd had another blizzard lie-up with Rod Rees-Jones.
Oh, yeah.
And a rather limited library.
Yeah, yeah, when we cut a book up, yeah.
Well, you did what?
I'd got a book, Hawaii, by James Michener, and I am not a quick reader. Rod devours books. He's a much quicker reader than me. And he kept saying, well, you're up and finish that book. I finished all mine. And he said, well, just tear the first four chapters out and let me read that. And eventually I did understand and said, yeah, because I didn't like, I thought it was desecration to actually tear a book apart. But this was a paperback and we were under extenuating circumstances, so we did. And the thing was that he was such a quick reader, although I gave him the first three or four chapters, I'd still only got to chapter 6 when he'd finished them. So eventually we swapped over and he finished the book and I would read the bits that were torn out. We were there for quite
ten,
a few days.
10 days, yeah.
10 days, yeah.
And there was one other book, apparently. Teach Yourself Spanish.
Oh, that was his. Yeah, yeah. Well, he'd read that and still not learned Spanish, so
he
wanted something else to read. And we'd got fed up of reciting the contents of a soup packet, which we could tell you how many monosodium glutamates there were in a packet of candy soup, things like this.
Another incident that Rod mentions is how the Huskies couldn't quite cope with your Lancashire accent.
Ah, no.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, when we at Pyramid Rock, it was decided that I would take Lou's place with him, with Rod. And Lou, because he'd got a lot of rocks to fetch back, he'd just found a new fossil bed, he would travel back with Brian Porter and Ian Ross, and they would go back, and I would stay out in the field with Rod to be part of the survey party with Jeff Lovegrove and Tony Haynes. Yeah, so I would become Rod's sledging partner for the first part, and then partway through that period we swapped over because we realised that Jeff and Tony were going to be staying out the whole of the season, and so it might be nice if they sledged with other people for a week or two. And I sledged with Jeff Lovegrove, and Tony sledged with Rod. But the first day with Rod, I'd not got any experience with dogs, really, apart from helping feed them and, you know, play with them on base. And my Lancashire dialect came out because I said to him, Rod had said something to me, and I said, ah, no, and the dog stopped. And he said, what do you say that for? I said, well, it's just an expression, you know. And he said, well, that stops the dogs. And, of course, ah, no, was the signal for the dogs to stop running. So I had to stop saying it. The other thing was that we came to a very, very large split in the ice, like a crevasse, but I mean it was probably 100 yards across, and it was full of snow, but of course the snow went like that. And he said, we're going to have to cross this. So we went over the lip and, of course, downhill like that. And then as you come to the other side, you're going up and you've got to get across the crack on the other side. And he said, shout at the dogs, shout at them. We've got to get them up there. You've got to shout. This was on my first day. and I was having trouble staying on skis, let alone shouting at dogs. So I shouted and the dogs were going, and then I have the ability to whistle rather loudly without using my fingers. And I whistled, and the dogs took off as though they'd got a something had hit them from behind. And we shot out of this, over this lip and up onto the ice again. And Rod said, "How did you do that?" And I said, "Well, that's the way I whistle. Save that till we need it." So, that was my first day of sledging with Rod. The first takeoff from Pyramid Rock, I finished up laying across the sledge because I couldn't stand up on skis. I was hanging on for grim death. Yeah.